The recent death on our campus of Professor Wendell Johnson has had one salutary characteristic to it, and that is it has brought home to Iowa City his two children, Nicholas Johnson, maritime administrator, and Katie Johnson, who's with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto. Both of you have distinguished yourselves in work at a very early age, and so I think our audience will be very interested in hearing what progress you have to report in your individual careers. Katie, since it's our practice to have ladies go first, what are you doing at the CBC?
It doesn't really have a name, I'm afraid.
Well, that's better than some of the circumstances you could be in.
When I first went to this, I'd better start with when I arrived in Toronto.
All right, now that was after you left Iowa City, as I recall.
Were you? I was in Europe for 2 years, mm-hmm. and I came through here, and I was here for several months, and then I went to Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And I got hired as hostess on a Toronto public affairs television series.
Mm-hmm. Just television or go-go or something?
No, called Generation, mm-hmm. a very serious-minded sort of show, mm-hmm. and it had to do with getting the older generation and the younger generations together.
Hmm. Did it ever work out?
Well, yes, compared to other shows, and mm-hmm. there aren't really any other shows like that, so I'd say that.
Now, this is television or radio?
This was television, mm-hmm. and I also then was story editor of that program. And then, last year, I continued to do that, but dropped the story editing on that and went with another program called This Hour Has 7 Days, mm-hmm. which is a one-hour-a-week primetime show in Canada. And what they were trying to do is something very interesting. As you probably know, Canadian television is half commercial and half non-commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And in public affairs, no commercials are allowed. So it's like one great big non-commercial network in public affairs. And This Hour Has 7 Days, which was the name of the show, came on right after Bonanza, which is carried on the CBC. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to carry that audience through an hour of public affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Which was something new, because most yes. public affairs in Canada tends to be a bit on the dried-up side.
So how long has the program been off the air?
It's still on the air, and it achieved the highest mm. rating of any series in CBC history.
I see. Maybe this does work, then. Feed them a little pablum and then give them something to think about.
Well, except that the pablum wasn't all on Bonanza.
Some of it was on the CBC.
It was a magazine format,
mm-hmm.
And they did a variety of things on each show, and they mixed it up. They had comedy. It was a little bit like That Was the Week That Was,
mm-hmm.
but they also had things which were definitely not comedy, and they did a lot of studio interviews and also film stories, and every fourth Sunday was a one-hour solid documentary.
Now, did you appear on the program or write it?
Yes, I did some interviewing on it.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired as a combination researcher-interviewer, so I was mainly doing research about 16 hours a day.
I'm sure many of our listeners will recall your series of children's programs on WMT television. Was that for two consecutive years or summers?
Two summers.
Yes. And that had something to do with the Ford Foundation, as I recall, or one of the foundations, did it not?
I believe it was subsidized. Mm-hmm. I don't know who was subsidizing it.
I see. Well, did that experience put you in good stead with the CBC, do you think?
Well, in terms of getting a job and saying I did this and that, I don't really think it did too much, because that had been 2 years ago, and it sounded very far away. Mm-hmm. Iowa really sounds far away when you're in Toronto. I think that personally, it certainly, in a more basic sense, gave me marvelous training.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have sort of been missing, in a sense. In Toronto, I have found that it's very, very rare that you go into a situation of the kind that I was lucky enough to go into it at WMT in Cedar Rapids, where you were hired, and although I was quite young then and really inexperienced, they sort of threw you a ball and let you carry it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find but that was just marvelous training. I'm terribly grateful for it, because most producers tend to be a little bit tighter than that.
Well, working with children is a fairly unpredictable kind of an experience in itself, isn't it? I mean, there was no way of controlling precisely what would happen on your program.
No, and we didn't want to. I mean, the unpredictability of it, I think, was part of the fun involved.
Would you have any idea what your brother's doing as maritime administrator?
No.
Well, I think this would be an excellent opportunity for us to find out. What does the maritime administrator do? I know he really has something to do with the merchant shipping of this country, but there must be a more complicated explanation.
Oh, I'm sure I could make it more complicated. Actually, we're in the business of subsidizing shipping, and I must say I, in many ways, would rather be in the business of subsidizing children's television programs, but in any event, that's not an option given me in this position. Mm. Maritime Administration is an agency of about 2,500 employees and budget of about $350 million a year. Its principal programs in terms of budget involve subsidizing the operation of ships, some 300 ships owned by 15 companies, and subsidizing the construction of ships. This is a subsidy program not for the shipping companies, but for the shipyards, for about 15 merchant ships a year, and that costs us another $100 million. In addition, we have other very important programs, but without that budgetary consequence. We're responsible for the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. This is the West Point in Annapolis of the Merchant Marine, as well as five state academies. We have responsibility for the reserve fleets of merchant ships. There are some 1,600 ships around the United States in eight different fleets.
These are the sort of thing we find up the Hudson River?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Sometimes referred to as the mothball fleet. They're
often filled with grain, too, aren't they?
Well, they were up until about a year and a half ago, but that was the program's been phased out shortly after I came in. We also have a research and development program. The United States has the world's only nuclear-powered merchant ship, the NS Savannah. Mm-hmm. This is a Maritime Administration project, along with the Atomic Energy Commission. We're also doing work with hydrofoils. The HS Denison is the world's only ocean-going hydrofoil. And we're now doing research in the area.
Can I interrupt a minute?
Certainly.
What is a hydrofoil?
Well, I think that's a good question. It's a ship that rides up out its hull is out of the water. The motor end is in the water, the propeller. And there are foils on the ship very much like an airplane's wings, and the same lift effect is provided in the water that the airplane's wing provides in the air. The foil is underneath the ship, so the effect is that the hull of the ship is lifted up out of the water, and the ship rides through the water on the hull, on the foil, rather than on the hull of the ship.
Now you know what a hydrofoil is. They've put them into operation on the Hudson River again, I understand, just recently for transportation, much like the ferry boats used to do. And I guess they are rather successful, except for debris in the river.
I had the opportunity to pilot one of these. I don't know what you call it, drive it or fly it or sail it or what it was I was doing, but I was hanging onto a wheel, and it has a capability to cut through a 4x4.
How fast?
Well, about whatever speed you want to make one go. These on the Hudson operate about 50 knots, 50 miles an hour, but there's nothing to keep you from designing one that would go 100 miles an hour.
But, and they're making some great big ones, aren't they? That would be passenger carrying, hundreds of passengers.
The Russians have one, which they quite symbolically call Sputnik, which carries 300 passengers comfortably and 700 with presumably some discomfort. It operates on the Volga at about 70 knots.
Well, you spoke of your primary purpose as being to subsidize shipping and shipbuilding in the United States, and I know that the question of subsidy and subsidization of American transportation is one that has troubled the president a great deal. He has taken some steps to improve, we know, city transit systems, and I understand that was a major step forward, though I'm not entirely conversant with the problems involved. What kind of a thing is most needed? What sort of development is most needed in your field?
Well, I think the principal problem in American shipping for the last 100 years, really, has been one of making it more competitive, making it more productive.
Competitive within the country or with other countries?
Well, I mean internationally competitive, mm-hmm. because by definition, the shipping business is a worldwide international business, and so your standard of competitiveness is that of the foreign nation, not of the United States. Mm. About in the middle and part of the 19th century, we had the capability in this country of building ships about $10,000 a ship cheaper than they could be built in Great Britain. We operated the world's largest and fastest sailing ships, the famous clipper ships out of Baltimore and elsewhere on the East Coast, and we were very profitably engaged in the shipping business at that time. And then along came steel and steam, and we decided that this should inspire us to build ever greater sailing ships, and we continued along that course until the early part of the 20th century, and then in World War I launched a massive shipbuilding program, which was concluded somewhat after the war, leaving us with a great supply of ships. And ever since then, we've been subsidizing the operation of shipping in the United States.
Mm. And the competition, I think, from other nations has grown much more intense, hasn't it?
Oh,
at least
yes.
In shipbuilding.
Yes, without question. Mm.
Well, I recall a recent article by Joseph Kraft, which I think you've seen. It was an editorial column which I saw reprinted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and had to do with the question of the 50% quota on shipping of Russian wheat or something that was to be bought in Russian corn or something that was to be bought in this country. I say I have just a smattering of a hint as to what it's all about, but are you involved in that? Were you involved
Yes,
in that?
Very much. Mm-hmm. Actually, at the time...
explain the problem and then tell me what the answer is.
In a general sense, we have a law in the United States referred to as PL 480 and also PL 664, both of which provide that shipments of agricultural surpluses out of the United States as a part of government programs will be carried 50% in American flag ships. Mm. Now, this creates some problem just in terms of competing for shipping in the world. This is obviously a discriminatory favoritism for our own ships. But the most severe problem is created by the fact that because our ships are uncompetitive in other than the subsidized segment, it means that we must charge more to move this grain on our ships than it would cost at world rates, roughly 2 to 3 times the world rate. And this amounts to a lot of money, and therefore a country which has an option to buy from the United States or buy elsewhere would often prefer to buy elsewhere and save the extra shipping charges. Now, the Russian wheat transaction, the first one, was just being resolved at the time I came into office in March of 1964. And since then, there have been no more large wheat sales in large measure, many believe, because of this requirement. Mm-hmm. And it constitutes one of the principal issues that the Maritime Advisory Committee and the Interdepartmental Maritime Task Force are now looking at in Washington. Mm-hmm.
It is kind of too bad that in the one area where we've had a great surplus and here had an opportunity to get rid of some of that surplus, another kind of subsidy, of course we've had farm subsidies for many years, but another kind of subsidy is now militating against that development, isn't that?
Yes, it's affected the balance of payments, the surplus that we have that we're not getting rid of, and what we could do with it in terms of feeding other peoples throughout the world. It's ironically enough also, of course, preventing the availability of jobs to longshoremen and seamen who would otherwise be carrying these commodities who have nothing to carry.
I want to come back to a question which has always bothered me with you and Nick, and that is whether most of the American shipping isn't actually under somebody else's flag anyway, but you be mulling over a response and try to straighten me out while I inquire of your sister Katie why she said Iowa seems such a long way from Toronto. So Toronto doesn't seem a very long way to me, and we hear the CBC a good deal, the CBC radio.
Well, I don't really mean that in a sense that they look down upon something like in that way. But they tend to pronounce it Ohio, for instance.
Uh-huh. Well, or Utah.
Or Idaho.
Well, then, are you developing big city ways, or does coming back to Iowa City, is that the kind of a thing you look forward to?
Oh, definitely. It's a hometown.
Well, I remember you as a saxophone player. I really should have promised not to bring this up. But you may remember that at the age of 15 or thereabouts, you played the saxophone in the All-State Music Camp. And for some reason, I was a member of the faculty that year. And so I always rather picture you carrying along an E-flat alto saxophone in a paper bag or something. But you're no longer interested in music. Of course, there is a theory that saxophone players never were interested in music.
I enjoyed the saxophone very much. I know it doesn't sound very ladylike, but I did. But I just bought a piano in Toronto, and I enjoy playing the piano very much.
Well, you have had more experiences in radio than most of us who are working in educational radio. You went abroad and did some interviews, I know about, and I don't know how you disposed of the interviews. Someone bought them, did they not?
I shipped some back to Monitor, which was operating then, and I was doing, well, the first year I was over, I did a weekly interview for WMT.
Now, how do you characterize the difference between our radio and your radio? It's half commercial, you say, a radio.
You mean Canadian radio?
Yes.
Our
commercial radio.
Well, there's also a lot of commercial radio in Canada.
I see, which is not owned and operated by the CBC.
Not at all. However, I think that even, the commercial radio is pretty much like it is here. But luckily, the CBC being a national network and being half non-commercial, they do much more in the ways of radio documentary. And even radio drama is still bigger there than it is in the States.
I heard a series from the CBC, and I mentioned it to you earlier. I think you said it was called Brain Drain, or it was at least based on the complaint which we're hearing in England, and I hadn't any idea we were hearing it in Canada, that vast numbers of the most talented people are leaving the country and going south, as they call it, into the United States. How serious a problem does this seem to be from your standpoint in Toronto?
Well, from my standpoint, they wonder what I'm doing there, and I tell them I'm reversing the brain drain. I think that it's very hard for me to answer because I've only been there for 2 years. I know that at the CBC, sometimes the very top producers use it as a training ground and then leave. However, I think you find in television that a lot of producers use television as a training ground and then go into film. But I think that that's partly not because they necessarily want to go to the States. They like the comparative non-commercial atmosphere, especially in something like public affairs. The CBC is having very sad difficulties right now.
I had read a report, or that a report was issued criticizing
Producers have been leaving because of conflicts between the, quote, creative side and the, quote, administrative side. There's been, the producers think that there's been a little too much censorship. And that's caused some people to leave. If they could get that straightened up, I think that very top people would stay there just because of the atmosphere.
Do you think they will straighten it up?
I think they're on the way to.
Well, Nick, I promised to ask you about this business of sailing under false colors. It seems to me every time I hear about an American-owned ship, it's flying the flag of Panama. Is there a good deal of that goes on, and do you have any control over American-owned shipping that flies somebody else's flag?
Well, there are a number of related issues here. The first point to make is that, by all odds, most shipping out of the United States is on foreign flag ships. Well over 90%
goes. These are not necessarily owned by Americans.
No, but they're flying a foreign flag. Now, of those, perhaps one-third are foreign flag ships owned by American citizens. We should perhaps explain why anyone would want to bother to do this. The answer is that an American flagship, one registered here, is required by law to carry an American crew, and the owner is required to replace his ships and replace them in American shipyards. And since American shipyards cost over twice as much as foreign shipyards, and the American crews get 3 to 5 times as much in wages as the foreign crews, he's really precluded economically from engaging in this kind of business unless he's subsidized. And there are operators who are not subsidized. So that gives him little option but to operate ships built in foreign yards and manned with foreign crews. This he can do, But then he must register his ships in a foreign country, and it's usually a country like Panama or Liberia or Honduras, where it's the countries that favor this kind of registration.
When you subsidize, what is the ostensible reason? Now, in the case of our airlines, we subsidize through airmail stamps, don't we? I mean, the postage is one way. We pay a lot of money for them to carry airmail, whether there's any airmail on it or not. Am I correct here? At least
that was true at one point in time. Actually, mm-hmm. The airlines now, I think, are really paid straight commercial rates for carrying the mail, much as they would be for any other cargo. It's today really a concealed subsidy.
Mm. Well, what do you do to help an American shipper or American?
Well, the ship operating subsidy is paid presumably under a theory that we need to have ships operating with American flags on them. Mm. This means with American crews, and there is a defense need for ships of this character, although we feel we also have control over ships owned by Americans operating under foreign flags. The subsidy is designed to pay a difference between the American cost of operation and the foreign cost of operation. Now, 85% of what we pay out of this $200 million a year is in fact a wage subsidy. It pays the difference between the foreign wage and the American wage. The rest of the amount we pay out goes for insurance, subsistence, and other smaller items of that kind. Mm. But roughly three-fourths of what the seaman receives in wages comes from the United States government, so that... And this is what interjects a remarkably confusing element into the judgment of the American ship owner. He's one of the only American employers who is paying, in effect, Japanese wages, you see, to his men. He doesn't have to pay the minimum wage. As a consequence, he doesn't have the incentive to cut back on his labor costs through increased productivity. Mm-hmm. And it is then a consequence of this that we... perpetuate the subsidy system and are not becoming more competitive than we are.
We know of a lot of rather sordid developments along the coastline of our country. I think of some of the problems involving various unions and some criminal elements operating within various unions having to do with the handling of cargoes. Does this problem come within your purview as a maritime administrator?
Well, yes, we don't pay a subsidy to the longshoremen, but to the extent that any government agency is concerned with the American longshoremen, it is the Maritime Administration as well as the Labor Department. And we have had our difficulties this year, there's no question about that. I think we had a period of probably 150 days when we had strikes for 100.
Yes.
So this has been a bad year by that standard, although this has also been a difficult year for the industry in terms of new policies that have been coming out of the Maritime Administration. I think we've made a great deal of progress, and this is a part of the price we pay for it.
Mm. Well, I don't mean to strike a tender part of the administrator's problem, but I do remember from the motion picture On the Waterfront, if that's what it was, and I also remember some of the hearings in which it was discovered that certain elements within some of the unions were in collusion with some of the shippers to disobey the law or otherwise to get around the course of supply and demand. And have you gotten through this phase of the thing?
Well, I would say only if this is a very colorful part of American society, yes. Mm-hmm. But we haven't engaged in any particular investigations of criminal activity in the waterfront or the seamen's unions.
Mm. I'm going to ask one more tender question, but this is more personal. I've watched Katie's career develop, and she's... had a good deal of training in radio and television and gone on into the CBC. How does one train to become a maritime administrator?
Well, one doesn't train to become a maritime administrator. Actually, my dad had a story he was fond of. When asked how he got into stuttering work, he would say he was like the man who was pulled out of the lake and asked how he came to fall in the lake. And he said, "I didn't come to fall in the lake. I came to fish." And my experience at the Maritime Administration is very much the same. I was teaching law at the University of California, Berkeley, and teaching administrative law, and I'd wanted to take a couple years leave, go to Washington, D.C., and practice before some of the agencies and as a professor, get a view of actual practice. And so that is why I came to Washington. I was to spend 2 years with Covington and Burling, and I had just concluded one when I was called over at the White House one afternoon and first encountered an agency known as the Maritime Administration, an agency that I subsequently came to learn a little something more about.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nothing that I had set out to do, so I My appointment was dubbed as a fresh approach to the maritime problems, which is another way of saying no experience at all, is what you've quite well put your finger on.
Well, I'm sure there are some areas of human endeavor in which no experience is possible, and maybe not even desirable, wouldn't you think?
Well, I think, if I may say so, that was in large measure what the maritime administration and the maritime industry needed. I don't mean me. Certainly I would get a wonderful argument on that. They view as probably I was the last thing they needed. But my own judgment, and apparently the president's, was that what the industry and the agency did need was someone who was not out of the industry, but someone who came, who had a capacity for thinking about problems in a fresh sort of a way, and who would tie into this thing and try to bring some new thought and new policies into an agency and an industry that had been sailing under the 1936 Act increasingly to their own doom for the last 30 years.
Now, you've been in this capacity for not quite 18 months.
That's right.
How do you feel about the progress that's been made under your administration?
Well, I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress, really. Just one example, we've built nothing but mechanized ships since I've been there. There have been a dozen or so of these built. These ships deliver 26% more in carrying capacity than the ships they replaced, and yet they operate for $100,000 a year less in subsidy cost than the ships they replaced. This is a very tangible and significant achievement, I think, and not one for which I take credit, needless to say. This is a function of the entire agencies working on this program. But the most substantial change, I think, is that the industry now is thinking. We have asked very fundamental questions like, why do we have an American merchant marine at all? Why do we have to subsidize one at all? And if so, why do we have to use this particular subsidy system that tends to deny the operators much incentive? And these kinds of questions are now being openly asked and openly discussed, and I think it needs to be done with many government programs. And this is the sort of thing President Johnson is trying to promote, is asking these very fundamental questions. What old programs can we simply discard? Which have outlived their usefulness? What do we need to replace them for the middle of the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century? And it's this kind of thinking that has been seen in greatest measure in McNamara's Defense Department that is now coming into the entire United States government. And I think that the impact of this, the revolutionary impact of it, is really going to be profound. And the Maritime Administration is, of course, just one small corner of this whole undertaking. Mm.
The president has been capable, it seems, of accomplishing remarkable progress in a variety of areas, particularly on the domestic scene, I think, and it often seems as though he manages to encompass so many aspects of American life and give vigorous support to all of them. Have you had this experience?
I frankly have been very, very impressed with the president. I did not know him before. I knew no member of his staff or anyone at all. But since I've been in the job, obviously I've had a number of occasions to be with him and talk with him and see him in action. And on each occasion, I have been impressed with his knowledge of and interest in what was going on, for example, at the Maritime Administration, which is, I would be the first to acknowledge, not the most important agency in Washington. And yet he's very much aware of what's going on there and very interested in it. And I think that his total commitment to the job, the tremendous amount of energy and time that he puts into it, is in large measure what we have seen as paying the dividends that have come out during his tenure.
Hmm. Well, Katie, our time is running, and I wanted to ask you just before we concluded what your plans are when you return to Toronto. Have you made some thoughts or had some thoughts about your work since you've been in Iowa that...
Well, not particularly since I've been in Iowa.
Do you have an assignment to do? Do you have assignments to do?
Yeah,
you have to do them?
I'm working on a film, which is going to involve living in a slum area, a part of Toronto called Cabbage Town,
goodness,
which I'm going to move into for 2 weeks to do a story on a young boy who's living there who's been in and out of penitentiaries.
I see.
Sort of the Tom Sawyer of Cabbage Town. And,
sounded to me like Peter Rabbit.
Well, that's quite a challenging undertaking in itself.
Yeah,
are you looking forward to this,
or
do you
much.
Have some trepidation about it?
No, I'm looking forward to it very, very much.
Well, we bid you bon voyage to Cabbage Town.
Thank you.
And we just bid the Maritime Administration bon voyage generally, I suppose, Nicholas. Thank you very much. Nicholas Johnson and Katie Johnson, the son and daughter of the late Wendell Johnson, a distinguished member of the faculty of the University of Iowa. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.